Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. Jordan says it will not release any Iraqi female terrorists until it receives proof that a Jordanian pilot held by Islamic State militants is still alive. A Jordanian government spokesman says authorities will consider exchanging the female suicide bomber for the pilot once they receive the proof they ask for.
At this point, we would like to emphasize that Jordan requested a proof of life for the life of the Jordanian pilot, and we have not received that yet.
In a recording posted online Wednesday, an audio message purportedly from a Japanese journalist also being held by the Islamic group said the pilot who was captured would be killed immediately if Jordan does not hand over the woman by sunset Thursday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is blaming Iran for Wednesday's flare-up of violence along the Lebanese border between Israel and the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah. Mr. Netanyahu says Israel will continue to defend itself against all threats. A suicide bomber attacked a funeral in eastern Afghanistan today. 16 people were killed and dozens wounded. An official says the attack took place in Laghman province during services for a police commander and three other people killed earlier in the day in a roadside blast. Residents in northeastern Nigeria's Adamawa State fled to the state capital Yola this week after a string of attacks by Boko Haram militants. Between Friday and Monday, insurgents hit at least five different villages in the Machika area. Residents said the fighters arrived on motorbikes and four-wheel drive vehicles and looted and burned houses. This is VOA News. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko today called for urgent ceasefire talks with pro-Russian rebels. He said the talks should result in an immediate ceasefire and withdrawal of heavy weapons from the front lines. Similar provisions were agreed to last September in Minsk, but that agreement has been violated repeatedly, with each side blaming the other for the breaches. European Union Justice and Interior Ministers are discussing ways to strengthen information sharing and border control to crack down on terrorism. Lisa Bryant takes a look.
Proposals by the EU Justice and Interior Ministers aim to bolster existing measures on surveillance, information sharing, and border control across the 28-member European Union. Earlier this week, EU Finance Ministers endorsed anti-money laundering measures and backed other proposals to cut off terrorist financing. The goal, to thwart jihadists from launching more assaults like the one that killed 17 people in Paris earlier this month. Lisa Bryant, Paris.
The organization Human Rights Watch says world governments make a serious mistake when they sacrifice human rights in the name of tightening security measures. In its annual review of global human rights released today, the group said Nigeria, Iraq, Syria, Israel, and the United States are among the nations using security concerns to justify the violation of human rights. According to Executive Director Kenneth Roth, tightening security can be counterproductive by eroding trust and aggravating tensions among groups.
So long as the Shia militia are targeting Sunnis because they are Sunni, it's making the Sunni population feel actually safer with ISIS than it would under rule by Baghdad. And that's a disaster for any effort to counter the severe atrocities of ISIS.
Executive Director Kenneth Roth. The World Health Organization said today efforts to slow the worst ever outbreak of Ebola have shifted to a focus on ending the epidemic. The number of new Ebola cases has fallen to its lowest weekly level since the end of June. A total of 99 new cases were reported last week in the most affected countries of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, according to new WHO figures. Aviation officials in Indonesia say an Air Asia flight that crashed into the Java Sea last month ascended steeply, then stalled and hurled toward the sea. They also said the co-pilot was at the controls at the time of the accident. Malaysia Airlines has formally declared the disappearance of last year's MH370 flight to be an accident. That means the 239 people aboard the flight are now presumed dead. On Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes are mixed at this hour. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
2014 was a turbulent year for human rights in Africa, says Human Rights Watch, which released its annual report Thursday. The international watchdog group says sectarian violence and abusive responses of government forces fueled many conflicts in the last year. The report, released on the eve of the African Union summit, also notes that African leaders have been too slow or too unwilling to react.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting. Details coming up.
Also, Amnesty International charges the Nigerian military had advanced warning of the attack on the city of Baga, but that the army failed to take adequate action to protect civilians.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, 2014 was a turbulent year for human rights in Africa, says Human Rights Watch, which released their annual report today. The international watchdog group says sectarian violence and abusive responses of government forces fueled many conflicts in the last year. The report, released on the eve of the African Union summit, also notes that African leaders have been too slow or too unwilling to react. VOA's Anita Powell attended the report's Africa launch and brings us this report from Johannesburg.
The rights group released its annual report just as Africa's heads of state began to converge on Ethiopia's capital for the annual African Union summit. The report echoes the main topics of this year's summit: the West African Ebola epidemic, Nigeria's brutal Boko Haram militants, and the conflict and instability in several African states. But one thing is missing from that discussion, say Human Rights Watch researchers: strong political will to improve human rights across Africa. Dewa Mavinga is a Human Rights Watch senior researcher for Zimbabwe and Southern Africa. He spoke at the report's Africa launch in Johannesburg.
We feel strongly that the AU could do more, and that it has, in many cases, been weak and slow in reacting.
The AU has consistently supported its own, voting in 2014 to give sitting African leaders and senior officials immunity from prosecution. And the continental body has awarded its presidency to several leaders who have been accused of heinous and widespread rights abuses, like Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, Equatorial Guinea's Teodoro Obiang, and, next in line, Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe. Aisling Reedy is a senior legal advisor for Human Rights Watch. She says the AU not only has the potential to radically improve human rights on the continent, it also has the muscle and the manpower.
They absolutely could make a difference. I mean, that resolution to which you refer is absolutely unacceptable. The idea that leaders in their self-interest are going to try to create some immunity, it's no longer acceptable in an era where we have the International Criminal Court, the first sitting permanent court, where we have the African courts here set up, that you can try to exempt people for the worst crimes. We're not talking about small crimes. We're talking about crimes against humanity and war crimes and torture and that. So if the AU was to put aside its short-term political interests and look at the interests of the people of Africa as a whole, it has the instruments at its disposal.
Reedy also notes some small advances in human rights, notably the AU's efforts to establish a court in Senegal to try Chad's former dictator, Hissène Habré. But Africa's greatest challenge this year, researchers note, comes from a natural source: the Ebola virus that spread across West Africa, killing more than 8,000 people, and, Reedy says, possibly threatening human rights.
Ebola crisis has thrown a very particular challenge, particularly obviously to West Africa, both in terms of the devastation it's had on the population and the potential to destabilize countries that have, you know, achieved pretty hard-fought gains on democracy and stability.
Human Rights Watch officials admit they are unpopular in many African nations, particularly the ones about which they are the most critical. They've repeatedly challenged governments to refute or act on the group's reports, with little success. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Amnesty International charges the Nigerian military had advanced warning of the attack on the city of Baga and a nearby military base, but that the army failed to take adequate action to protect the civilians. Amnesty's Africa director, Nathan Nathbalai, gave details of his group's conclusions in a statement released today. It said that officials at the multinational joint forces camp in Baga reported to military authorities in the capital about Boko Haram troops build-ups over a two-month period before the January 3rd attack by the Islamist insurgents. Estimates of the death toll in Baga and surrounding villages are in excess of 2,000. Nazanet says Nigeria's military leadership woefully and repeatedly failed in their duty to protect civilians of Baga and Monguno, despite repeated warnings. Nigerian government defense spokesman General Chris Olokoade replied in a statement that Amnesty's report is misleading, inaccurate, and unfair.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says food security in Somalia has actually improved of late following years of drought. But as experts point out, Somalia's food situation is still far from normal. Hilary Hewler has more from Nairobi.
The disastrous dry spells that have racked war-torn Somalia for years seem to have loosened their grip on the country, at least for the moment. New figures released by the FAO on Wednesday show that the most recent rains in Somalia were normal, and that the number of people facing a food crisis has declined over the past 6 months by around 30%. But these improvements may be temporary. Nina Dodd, who works with the UN Food Security and Nutrition Analysis Unit, points out that other key indicators, such as child malnutrition, have not been improving. In some places, she says, they've actually been getting worse.
Food security is not only responsible for nutrition. Malnutrition can be caused by a lot of factors. In the South Central Somalia, the situation is worse. We see critical levels of malnutrition.
The devastating famine that struck Somalia between 2010 and 2012 killed more than a quarter of a million people, half of them children under the age of five. The country's UN humanitarian coordinator at the time said the international community was partly to blame, having not acted quickly enough to counter the effects of a severe drought. FAO's Rudy Van Aken says that although food security may have improved since then, the population is still vulnerable to even the slightest shock.
Somalia is not out of the woods, that's clear. We had a slight improvement in part of the country this time around, but we are not back to a situation as before the famine in 2010. Many more people, 750,000, are still in crisis and emergency. And we don't see that this is a result of a sustainable improvement. It's more the impact of the last rainy season, which happened to be quite good. But the next one may be just as well be bad again.
Continued support for farmers and pastoralists is needed to protect them against future droughts and dry spells, says Van Aken. The FAO's current programs include vaccination of herds, irrigation, and the introduction of drought-resistant crops. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehis Wuhid, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Amnesty International charges the Nigerian military had advanced warning of the attack on the city of Baga, but that the army failed to take adequate action to protect civilians. And Human Rights Watch says 2014 was a turbulent year for human rights in Africa. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The largest Ebola treatment center in West Africa is downsizing as the number of new cases declines in the three countries affected. The Liberia Field Coordinator for Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, says they are cutting back on capacity at their 120-bed facility in Monrovia's Elwa Hospital. The unit overflowed with patients in mid-August, but will be reduced to serve 30 patients by the end of February. Duncan Bell said the treatment center is reducing health worker staff and burning canvas tents, but he added they can scale up again if needed. In Geneva yesterday, Liberian Commerce Minister Axel Addy reported 12 of 15 counties have reported no new cases.
Tracking the spread of the virus remains a problem. Liberia confirmed only 4 new cases last week, but the World Health Organization reports that the government has not reported contacts for 2 of them. The WHO target for ending the crisis in all 3 countries is the capacity to trace 100% of Ebola patient contacts. The percent of patients' contacts is lower in Guinea, 30% among the 20 new cases. There is no report on contacts for new cases in Sierra Leone, a country which had 366 new cases in the past 3 weeks. That was the highest number of new cases for any of the 3 countries. In that 21-day period, Guinea had 92 new cases and Liberia had only 20. The head of the WHO Ebola response says, you still have an incredibly dangerous situation. Dr. Bruce Ayel Ward warned the Ebola outbreaks come in waves. The Secretary General of Doctors Without Borders has criticized the efforts to trace and monitor Ebola contacts Ebola patients have had before being hospitalized for treatment. James Oberit said on Sunday that the 3 countries do not share surveillance information.
The United Nations Children's Fund is appealing for a record-breaking $3.1 billion to assist 62 million children facing conflict, disease, and other humanitarian crises. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of UNICEF's Humanitarian Action for Children 2015 appeal in Geneva.
The biggest chunk of the money, nearly $1 billion, targets the deepening emergencies in Syria and affected areas nearby. An additional $500 million will be used to scale up efforts to tackle the devastating Ebola epidemic in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. The appeal will provide assistance to 98 million people in 71 countries. Two-thirds of the beneficiaries are children. UNICEF's Director of Emergency Programs, Afshan Khan, says children are more at risk today than ever before from conflict, hunger, disease, and abuse.
1 in 10 children around the world, 230 million, currently live in countries and areas that are affected by armed conflicts. And children are increasingly targets of war, violently attacked at home, at school, in the street, and used as weapons and forts to fight in armed groups. Conflicts are no longer isolated to one country, but have spilled over to create crises in neighboring countries as well.
This can be seen in the Middle East. UNICEF pinpoints the Syrian conflict as the world's worst humanitarian crisis among the many tearing apart the lives of children and their families. The agency reports 12.2 million people there are in need of humanitarian aid, including 5.6 million children in Syria and in neighboring countries. While the needs in this area are enormous, Khan says UNICEF is also dealing with many other regional crises.
And we cannot ignore the needs of children in a Central African Republic, which equally has a knock-on effect on places like Chad and other neighboring countries, Nigeria, in Cameroon. Each of those children should be given an opportunity to have a basic education, basic access to health care, clean water, and be protected.
Meanwhile, Ebola continues to take a heavy toll on children. UNICEF reports about 10,000 children in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea have lost one or both parents to the outbreak, and many are stigmatized and shunned by their communities. UNICEF Global Ebola Emergency Coordinator Peter Salama says it is important that these 3 countries are not forgotten as Ebola declines over the next few months.
As we hopefully successfully eliminate the virus, we have to make sure that these countries and the people in them, particularly the children, benefit in the long term, because these are some of the most neglected countries on earth.
UNICEF says it will use money from the appeal to scale up efforts to rapidly isolate and treat every case of Ebola, prevent further outbreaks, and continue to promote healthy behaviors to prevent the spread of the disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
New research shows that dogs are no longer the primary source of a disease that has infected and killed lions in Tanzania. Canine distemper now appears to be spread mostly by other carnivores, such as hyenas, jackals, and foxes. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
In 1994, about 30% of the lions in Serengeti National Park died from what was then a mysterious neurological disease. It was later identified as canine distemper. Veterinarian Felix Lancaster says the dynamics of the distemper virus are extremely complex.
Canine distemper is an infectious disease that's caused by a virus called the canine distemper virus, which is in the same family as measles and rinderpest. So it's a viral infection that affects dogs commonly, but it can also infect wild carnivore species.
In the 94 outbreak, domestic dogs were responsible.
There are lots of domestic dogs living in human communities around the national park. And there's one particular area from the northwest of the national park where there's a lot of people and quite a high density of dogs.
Lancaster says since then, blood samples of various animals have been tested for signs of canine distemper.
What we found is that there have been peaks in antibodies in the lion population. So the virus has come into the population since the 1994 outbreak. And what we were expecting to see is that those peaks would be related to peaks of antibodies in the domestic dog population, showing that the domestic dog population had an outbreak of distemper, and that would be then followed by an outbreak in the lion population.
However, the antibody peak in lions did not correspond to a peak in domestic dogs, so the dogs were not the primary source. Lancaster says the canine distemper virus is spread by physical contact.
Social contact within a social group like a lion or a domestic dog, by dogs licking each other or grooming each other, fighting, mating. But it's also spread from species to species. We think at points of contact, like when carnivores scavenge at a carcass and you get multiple species at that carcass and they might fight with each other or they might eat a bit of meat or a bone that's already been contaminated with the saliva from one animal. That is an area where disease can move from one species to another.
And animals eat one another. Hyenas, for example, may prey on domestic dogs around Serengeti National Park. However, there hasn't been much evidence the canine distemper virus has affected hyenas much. And sometimes the virus can even pass through a lion population with few, if any, symptoms.
It's a very curious disease. Sometimes it causes outbreaks that are clinically apparent with lots of death and diseased animals. And other times it passes through and you don't see any symptoms whatsoever.
Lancaster says the canine distemper virus now may be established in the wild among several carnivore species rather than the domestic dog population. A big reason for that may be domestic dogs around Serengeti National Park are being vaccinated for distemper, rabies, and the parvovirus.
It's probably reduced the intensity of transmission of the virus into the national park and into lion populations. But what we're seeing is that it hasn't prevented the lions from becoming infected completely. And so there is clearly some other transmission going on that the vaccination campaign has not managed to prevent.
Lancaster says evidence of it spreading into other animals can be found in eastern Russia, where Siberian tigers are now becoming infected and dying.
There's a lot more work to be done to understand really how the virus is working, how it's changing, how it's mutating, how new species are becoming infected with it, and what the implications are of those species becoming infected.
Lancaster is a clinical assistant professor at the Paul G. Allen School for Global Animal Health at Washington State University. However, he's based full-time in Arusha, Tanzania. While research continues into canine distemper, he also focuses on rabies, which is widespread in Africa and Asia.
Rabies is what we call a neglected tropical disease. It's causing fatalities all around the world. Every year, approximately 69,000 people are dying of rabies. Almost half of those are children under the age of 16. as we all know, it's a horrific disease. It's one of the most lethal diseases known to mankind, which means that once somebody becomes infected and symptomatic, they nearly invariably die.
He says in Africa and Asia, the disease is nearly always transmitted by domestic dogs. It's entirely preventable with vaccines. Lancaster and his colleagues are campaigning for funds to establish national canine vaccination campaigns to eliminate rabies on those continents. In the United States, the rabies reservoir is usually wild animals such as raccoons and skunks. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Just like the controversy around mammograms used to find breast cancer, there is a lot of debate about tests used to diagnose prostate cancer. Critics say both procedures find small tumors that should be left alone, and they often fail to find the ones that are dangerous. Fortunately, a new study shows doctors may soon have a more reliable way to diagnose prostate cancer. More from VOA's Carol Pearson.
Prostate cancer seems to run in Ronald Briscoe's family.
My older brother, my father had it, and also my baby brother has it.
Family history has a lot to do with a man's chances of getting an aggressive type of prostate cancer. One study shows if a man's male relatives had it, his risk could be up to 3 times higher than normal. Unlike breast cancer, which can be found with a mammogram using a low dose of radiation, advanced imaging is not normally used to diagnose prostate cancer. Doctors use ultrasound to guide them as they take tissue samples of the prostate. Ultrasound uses sound waves, a safer technology than radiation, but Dr. Peter Pinto from the National Cancer Institute says it falls short of what doctors need.
Ultrasound ensures that the needles hit the prostate, but we don't use the ultrasound to direct the needles into where the tumor may be present.
Dr. Manoj Siddiqui says biopsies guided by ultrasound are hit or miss.
You randomly try to get all the prostate sample in hopes of catching the cancer.
In contrast, an MRI uses a magnetic field and radio waves to give a detailed picture of part of the body.
MRI can tell us where tumors are hiding in the prostate. It's not normally sampled.
That's how Ronald Briscoe's cancer was found. He participated in a large study at the National Cancer Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Siddiqui led the study, which involved 1,000 men at high risk for prostate cancer. One group had a biopsy using both ultrasound and MRI technology. The other group had standard ultrasound-guided biopsies. Dr. Pinto was one of the co-authors.
The targeted MR-guided biopsy had a 30% increase in detection of high-risk prostate cancer as compared to the traditional biopsies performed today.
Dr. Siddiqui plans more clinical trials, but he says the results of this preliminary study are promising.
The benefit of doing that is that we maximize our ability to detect the high-risk cancers that matter and also potentially avoid the harm of detecting cancer which is clinically insignificant and unlikely to cause problems for the patient.
The study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Join with leaders like President Sirleaf.
Malaria stops footballers from scoring and students from learning.
And join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
United, we can beat malaria.
Ha, ha, ha.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Human Rights Watch says 2014 was a turbulent year for human rights in Africa. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says food security in Somalia has actually improved. And the UN Children's Fund is appealing for a record-breaking $3.1 billion to assist 62 million children facing conflict, disease, and other humanitarian crises. Coming up, we'll have music from Tanzania. And in our feature segment, we focus on the rate of HIV in South Africa, one of the highest in the world. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. It's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young today. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we kick off with African football.
Okay, great.
Thank you. It's a rest day at the African Cup of Nations finals in Equatorial Guinea. Action resumes Saturday, January 31st, with two quarterfinal matches. Congo will play against Congo DR earlier on at about 4 p.m. local time. Then Tunisia will take on Equatorial Guinea later. The other quarterfinal matches will be played on Sunday, February 1st, 2015. Ivory Coast takes on Algeria and Ghana faces Guinea. The winner between Guinea and Mali was decided by lots earlier today. For more on Africa Cup of Nations, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma.
Kevin Constant converted a penalty to put Guinea ahead in the 15th minute. Then Modiba Maiga headed home the equaliser in the 47th minute as Mali came from behind to hold Guinea to a 1-1 draw in Mongomo on Wednesday. Elsewhere, Maxine Alain Gradel scored his second goal of the tournament in the 36th minute to secure Ivory Coast's 1-0 triumph over Cameroon in the capital Malabo in the other Group B tie. This is the only match in the group that produced a winner. The other five encounters resulted in 1-1 draws. Consequently, Ivory Coast tops the group with 5 points and is through to the quarterfinals. Guinea and Mali tie in second place with 3 points and an identical goal average, while Cameroon is at the bottom of the group with 2 points. Staying in Malabo, Cameroon's captain Stefan Mbia concedes that inexperience among the young Cameroonian side cost them a place in the quarterfinals. Speaking through an interpreter in a post-match interview, Mbia elaborates.
This team is very young. We are here to learn, but it is, after all, AFCON. You are here for you to do well and be in front. In this game, we are behind and not focused.
That was Stefan Mbia, Cameroon's captain, speaking in Malabo. Finally, with Guinea and Mali tied in second place at the end of the Group D preliminaries, the tournament organizing committee will follow Article 74 of the Orange Africa Cup of Nations regulations. They will conduct a random draw to determine which two teams will advance to the quarterfinals at the Hilton Hotel in Malabo at 4 p.m. today, Thursday.
Thanks. That was Mark Homer reporting from Johannesburg. And Mark's report was filed before the draw of lots in which Guinea qualified for the quarterfinals. As I was saying, the draw was just held today, earlier today. The two sides had finished level in Group D after both drawing all three of their matches 1-1. Meanwhile, Mali and Guinea managers have criticized drawing of lots to decide who qualifies for the quarterfinals. The managers insisted drawing of lots should not have been how their Africa Cup of Nations fate is decided. Guinea coach Michel Duseyou is quoted saying, "Mali do not deserve to be eliminated in this way, just as we do not. It's not fair for both teams," he said, just before the draws, suggesting the outcome could have been settled by penalty kicks or extra time. The team who deserved to win would do it on the pitch, he added.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Yes, this is Sunny Side of Sport. Now, let's move on to tennis, where Andy Murray came storming back after a poor start to beat Tomas Berdych and reach his fourth Australian Open final. The British number one lost a tense first set but recovered to win 6-7, 6-0, 6-3, 7-5. It will be his eighth Grand Slam final and the first working with Amelie Maremso, with ex-coach Danny Valverdu now in Berdych's corner. The 27-year-old Murray will play the winner of Friday's semi-final between Novak Djokovic and Stan Wawrick. The Scots' hopes were under threat after losing a tension-filled opening set, but he turned it round with a brilliant lob early in the second and took control with seven straight games. The 29-year-old Berdych had started much the better and served for the set at 5-3, only for Murray to break straight back in a rally of huge forehands and celebrate widely in the direction of the Czech's player's box. The Czech, who beat Rafael Nadal for the first time since 2006 in the quarterfinals, then suffered an unexpected collapse as Murray's game began to flow.
African Music Mix.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. North to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Tune in from 0 to 300 hours UTC and from 11 to 1300 hours UTC every single day on the Voice of America.
In athletics, Ukrainian Sergei Bobka will challenge fellow Olympic champion Sebastian Coy for the presidency of the International Association of Athletics Federations. Bobka, a former pole vaulter, won an Olympic gold in 1988, as well as six consecutive world championship titles. The 51-year-old, who also set 35 world records, wants to replace Limane Diak when he steps down in August. Fellow IAAF Vice President Coy, a double Olympic champion in the 1500 meters, announced his candidacy late last year. Bobka, who is head of his country's Olympic committee, said he wanted to build on the work of Diak, adding, "We also need to provide greater grassroots support to inspire the next generation of athletes." Potential candidates for the IAAF presidency must register by May, with the election due to take place at the IAAF Congress in Beijing in August.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Meanwhile, the International Association of Athletics Federations, IAAF, has just launched its new online platform for potential host cities of its World Athletics Series events. The new bidding website and newsletter will allow cities to access the latest information about bidding for IAAF events, including event descriptions, bidding timelines and procedures, host cities' rights and obligations, as well as best practices from past and future host cities of IAAF events. By creating this website, the IAAF aims to reach more cities and provide them with relevant information about IAAF events. All events are different in scope and size and offer cities of all sizes the opportunities to host world-class athletics competitions. And that's it for this edition of the Sunnyside Sports. I'm Douglas Mpoga. Now back to you, Kim.
Okay, thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunnyside of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny will have an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunnyside of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, focusing on the rate of HIV in South Africa, one of the highest in the world. And next, the New York Times newspaper has endorsed Zimbabwe as one of the best tourist destinations this year. But first, some music. Here is South Africa's AM to PM with Love Shy.
Yeah.
South Africa's AM 2 p.m. with Love Shy.
Well, the rate of HIV in South Africa is one of the highest in the world, with 6.2 million people now infected with the virus that causes AIDS. Medical clinics remain woefully underfunded and understaffed, and getting infected people to remain on lifelong therapy is a challenge. But so-called adherence clubs are making the job a little easier. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
What do you do if you are HIV positive and faced with taking a daily regimen of life-saving antiretroviral drugs, and you have to travel dozens of kilometers to a clinic and queue up for hours to get refills on the drugs, which cause unpleasant side effects such as nausea and diarrhea? That is the reality for many HIV-infected people. Those who do not feel sick may decide to stop taking their medication or only take it sporadically. That may cause a resurgence of the virus and lead to the development of AIDS. To prevent that, the non-governmental health organization MSF, Doctors Without Borders, has begun to set up adherence clinics in South Africa. In an interview with the New England Journal of Medicine, MSF field coordinator Lynn Wilkinson said the idea is to make it easier for relatively healthy HIV patients to stay engaged and on schedule with their lifelong therapy.
By requiring healthy patients to still come to clinics or to healthcare facilities to get treatments and care makes no sense when we're already overstretched. And so being able to manage patients in their communities, making it easy for them to stay on treatment, is definitely the way forward.
The community-based adherence clubs meet once every 2 months and now have some 30,000 members around South Africa's Western Cape province. Trained counselors run the 45-minute-long group sessions, during which participants discuss challenges and adherence to treatment. They are given a prepackaged 2-month supply of antiretroviral drugs. The state of their health, according to Wilkinson, is tracked at the meetings with a rapid blood test that tells health workers how much virus is in the patient's system.
We can, through the viral load test, see whether the patient is adherent. If they're not adherent, potentially red flag the patient for increasing support and perhaps returning to the clinic for enhanced care. But really being able to say to our healthy patients, well, to be honest, you're not sick anymore. We don't need to see you at the clinic.
Wilkinson says the biggest challenge remains reaching HIV-infected men, many of whom wait until they're very sick before coming in for treatment, and young women who may not think they are harboring the AIDS virus. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The New York Times newspaper has endorsed Zimbabwe as one of the best tourist destinations this year. Zimbabwe was 14th in the paper's last Sunday edition, with Milan, Cuba, Philadelphia, Yellowstone National Park, and Chile claiming the top 5 spots. The paper said it gathers ideas from its contributing writers in various parts of the world. Zimbabwe's Minister of Tourism, Walter Zembe, has embraced Zimbabwe's inclusion on the list. He told a reporter in Tungamali in Como, his ministry has been working hard to attract tourists.
It's an endorsement of brand Zimbabwe, coming as it does on the back of a very successful 2013, when we hosted the UNWTO General Assembly, the 20th session, which was attended by excess of 144 countries, over 50 ministerial representations, 400 media, 800 affiliate organizations. Arguably the most successful General Assembly in the UNWTO family since the inception of the General Assemblies. So I think it registered with the world that we are a peaceful destination, secure, with a very attractive product, as it were.
How would you characterize the tourism industry at the moment?
Well, we've just broken the 2 million barrier. I'm signposting a 5 billion tourism economy by the year 2020, 5 million arrivals, contribution to GDP, what I popularly dub here as the 5-5-15-2020 vision for the tourism sector.
Countries like the United States are heavily reliant on local tourism. Is that something that you are encouraging as the minister? And are there any incentives for local tourists?
It is tourism that is going to be the catalyst for economic recovery, because with minimum but significant investment, we can position it to basically provide the much-needed cash flow in the economy. And what it takes is to receive visitors, give them a good experience that will make them retain again. How do we get there? We must facilitate the accessibility of our destination.
Zimbabwe Tourism Minister Walter Mzimba was speaking from Harare with reporter Tungamili Nkomo. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Audrey Swigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Of the estimated 35.3 million people living with HIV/AIDS, some 3.2 million are children under the age of 15. Most of them, about 91%, live in sub-Saharan Africa. In 9 out of 10 cases, these children were infected during pregnancy, childbirth, or through breastfeeding. At birth, a baby's immune system is not fully developed. In a healthy child, it fully develops by about 6 months, but up to that point, the infant's immunity is boosted by antibodies transferred from the mother through breast milk. When mothers with HIV receive the proper medications, they can safely breastfeed their infants. However, when HIV-infected mothers do not receive anti-HIV medicines, their infants are at risk of becoming infected. Children with HIV infection often get sick. They have a difficult time fighting off common childhood maladies such as ear and sinus infections, pneumonias, urinary tract infections, intestinal illness, skin disease, and meningitis. In developing countries in particular, tuberculosis, diarrhea, and respiratory illnesses are common in HIV-positive children. If an HIV-positive child does not receive antiretroviral treatment, a cycle of illness may set in and further undermine the child's health. 80% of children infected with HIV at birth or in infancy die before their fifth birthday. It is therefore important to begin treating HIV-positive children with antiretroviral drugs as soon as possible. If taken every day, proper medication can drastically reduce the concentration of HIV in the bloodstream, thereby slowing the progression of the disease. But sadly, only 24% of HIV-infected children have access to antiretroviral drugs. That is why the United States, through the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, in partnership with the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, launched the Accelerating Children's HIV/AIDS Treatment, or ACT, initiative. This two-year, $200 million program aims to double the number of children receiving antiretroviral treatment. Through this initiative, some 300,000 additional children living in Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Lesotho, Malawi, Mozambique, Tanzania, Zambia, and Zimbabwe will get a better chance to grow to adulthood and lead full, healthy lives. Healthy children who can pursue their dreams are Africa's future. They will grow economies, create jobs, and contribute to their families and communities for decades to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent, old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mpuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share the ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Here's advice from the international medical group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, to help limit the spread of the Ebola virus. First, do not touch or eat the bushmeat of animals from the forest. Avoid contact with blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, or genital secretions of an Ebola patient. Do not handle the bodies of the patients who have died of Ebola. Inform the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases. Seek health care immediately, because infected people have a much higher survival rate if they receive early treatment at a health facility compared to staying home. These are recommendations from the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, on how to prevent the spread of Ebola.